Hi, I'm Dr. Ruth D'Souza, and this is Birthing Injustice. This podcast is recorded on the unceded lands of the Boonwurrung people of the Kulin Nations. Today we're talking about being an arts practitioner and mother from Palestine with Asil Taya. Asil is a community arts practitioner who now lives in Melbourne. She's passionate about storytelling and lullabies and committed to creating networks and sharing skills between diverse groups of people. I'm so excited about sharing this beautiful conversation, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. Asil, can you tell us a little bit about you and whose land you're on?
I am on the land of the Boonwurrung people, and I work and share my art on together with many other lands, mainly the Wurundjeri people. And Yora Yora communities, that's kind of where most of my work happened. And I'm basically so grateful that I get the chance to create all this work with the love and support of brothers and sisters and elderly communities that share art and culture with me every day. Yeah.
And why do you care about birthing?
I think we should all care about birthing. I think it's a human thing that we are born with, we are lucky that we're born with inside us. As a mom, I care much more about birthing now than I did 10 years ago because of the magic that I taught myself and the little human that was like a little kind of dot jumping when I first saw her until she is a brilliant girl. I learned a lot about myself and about humanity and about nature and about God, about spirituality, about every element of life. I see differently with a different lens because of birth. It's maybe a process that takes between a minute to a few days in kind of the actual aspect of it. But it's a life thing and process that we don't often look at and deeply breathe and kind of bring inside us. I shouldn't know anyone that don't care about birth because that's where they are all from, you know?
Yeah, we're all born, right? And how did you find becoming a mother in Australia?
Hard, tough, challenging, and lacking the village, for sure. I was born and raised in a village. My mom was away from her own village. I was born and raised in Jerusalem. But she had the aunties around her. Not necessarily in her own village, but outside of it, away from it. She found her place where it was hard for me in the first life of my daughter to kind of, you know, raise her in this place. I suffered from postnatal depression badly after that. And part of it is also from not having the right community around me, from not knowing when to ask and how to ask and where and from whom. I think we have a lot to do before this place is really welcoming and warm for people that is really wanting to create life on this, you know, planet in a migrant country where like everybody comes from different places. But also slowly I built that. I'm not 100% there yet. Raising my daughter by myself at the moment with my husband in your home is hard. So it's kind of, I really wish we are much more progressing in that space to support women, migrants, refugees. At least I have the language, but many don't. And how do they really find and, you know, exist in this world of Australia, sharing, you know, life and livelihood with children that just came to this life, not knowing any language and any way to communicate with the system, which is a very tricky system, is hard. So I'm lucky. I didn't give birth in Gaza where war is happening. I didn't give birth in Jerusalem when every mom is a target. So I consider myself lucky in that way, but unlucky in the lack of that communities I really miss and I wish they were in my life for sure.
Yeah, I really felt your pain, Asil, when you were saying how lonely and isolated it was for you. I could feel it across the air between us. And were there some special customs and traditions that were important to you from your Palestinian heritage that you wanted to incorporate into being a parent?
Of course, like, you know, just the fact that you have your mom and dad around you, the grandfather's existence in your child's life is like an A, you know, in life, where she didn't have it. The language and the stories and the storytellings that she learns from, not only, so in Palestine, there's not only one like grandmother, there's like 10 of them, or maybe 20. And they all have their own way of spoiling, but of life. Like some will teach her the kitchen, you know, side of it, and some will teach her the gardening, and some will teach her, you know, just to ride that horse or a donkey in some cases and ride that. There is life, you know. I like this quote of Rafif Ziyad, this like poem, which is like, we Palestinian wake up every day to teach the rest of the world life. I think, you know, many aunties really teach the word life at home, like what life is. And when you are in a privileged country, there's some aspects of real life that you don't really live and you don't really experience, and you miss because you don't know about them and you haven't, you know, lived it in real, you know, spaces and real situations that I would like her to feel. There's all these traditions in Fridays that as mums we have, as a community we have. There's the call for prayers that is forbidden in like to hear in here, like in a big kind of things. There's like the walk into the mosque. There's many small things in Eid that don't happen in Australia for many reasons that I am still trying to figure out myself. There's really life. Like, I would love my daughter to learn life that she's missing in Australia that, like, happens everywhere else around the world. The plays and the games and the kind of running around in the neighborhoods, no matter how safe they are, they exist, where everybody here is, like, running from soccer to, you know, this kind of thing to that kind of thing, but not really, you know, living the childhood that I would love my daughter to have behind the screens and behind, you know, these closed doors.
Yeah, I was thinking about, you know, how you moved from Jerusalem to Western Australia. What brought you to Australia and what kind of work are you doing at the moment?
What brought me to Australia is destiny. My husband cannot be in my own country and I cannot be in his. I would call myself a love refugee, if that is a way to explain it. And Australia was a place for me to exist and be feeling safe and feeling, you know, I have a shelter, and safe for my husband, being a Syrian man himself. What I do, I tell stories in many ways. I tell stories of my grandma's dish and my mom's song and my dad's, you know, way of, you know, growing a strawberry field. I share my life through stories with amazing artists that I'm so lucky to be, you know, sharing this world with, to kind of just raise awareness about our cultures, our homes, our traditions and our, you know, souls as artists.
So you are saying that your husband's from Syria and you moved to Western Australia together because it's somewhere you could be. And one of the things I was very struck by, because I listened to a few of the interviews with you, is the kind of huge, huge effort you've put into intercultural understanding in your work. Does that shape your work a lot?
Yeah. Like, I think, you know, we live in a country that has so many different cultures, even like within the Palestinian one. Like, I'm a Palestinian that was born and raised in Jerusalem, but I come here and I find other Palestinians that were born in different Gulf countries or different, you know, diaspora communities. And that by itself, we are all Palestinians, but we have different ways of phrasing, different songs we got used to, different, you know, dishes that we make. And like, we all always have this kind of even, you know, conversations about who's more Palestinian. And that's just within Palestine and within one specific heritage. So think about all the more than 300 languages and cultures and people and like the interactions between different communities. And how can that be even more enriching if we talk about those interactions and intercultural connections that we create? I started with talking about Palestine, but then talking about Western Australia, it was the very first time I knew about the First Nation story. So imagine and it's lack of reading from my own side, for sure, because maybe I was too deep into the Israeli occupation and all that's happening in back home and so on. But I didn't know much about the Australian story before I came to WA. And then I was telling my partner that these people are so much like Palestinians. We are loud, we are saying things like, and he, this is where the first time I knew about Aboriginal people. I actually didn't even speak fluent English or as good English at all. And I said, up what? Like, what's that word? And he said, Google it. And I started reading about this. And like, I felt there's so many similarities that really actually now shaping my work of like talking to more brothers and sisters in different places and saying, finding the common and the difference between us in culture. I just cannot not do that. When people say, why do you insist on creating those partnerships? I don't think that I have an option. You know, I'm a Palestinian. I'm someone that colonization have affected my life, my soul. I was born in 1987. And talking about birth and motherhood, when people think why I'm so angry, and you know me enough, Ruth, I am. I have this passion. I was born and fed bitter milk. I'm a 1987 born Intifada girl that all she was fed is, you know, the kind of life and the milk of a mum that saw people being beaten on front of her, felt the threatened of every step she was walking in Jerusalem. I would not be a normal human being. What normal is, I don't know, but I would not be as others when that's my childhood. When I lived all my, you know, like few first years in, you know, some insecure places to come into the safe, what's so called Australia, and kind of trying to find that I am also part of a colonizing system. I am not on a land that of, you know, on a free land that its people, just like Palestinians, have been struggling for years and years and hundreds of years to exist and share their own language, their own culture, their own life on this and the land of their own, but they're not freely doing that yet. So intercultures, I think, should be part of every person's life. It's kind of the A of like you are on a land of colonized, you know, nations, not one, hundreds. So you should know that. And then you should know those around you and their common pain, because you heal and become a normal, like, you know, you lead into a healed, decolonized system when you share the stories and you kind of heal slowly together as a collective. And like, as a child, and I wrote, talking about, you know, my studies, and I wrote my thesis about lullabies and how lullabies were the healing. But I learned from intercultural world as well, and intercultural like collaborations, the amazing lullabies as healing through different cultures. What I assumed was a personal experience was surprisingly, and maybe not surprisingly, a collective nationally and internationally, across cultures and continents, a way to heal through the motherhood, the lullabies, the intercultural sharing of people migrating from a place to a place to be the taking care of like children across nations and across, you know, villages and cities and countries that wrote the lullabies for children for like 100 years to come. So I think that's an A to any community practitioner. They have to kind of work interculturally with different nations, first to understand themselves and then to understand others, you know?
Asil, you've got an intercultural collaboration happening at the moment with someone Indigenous. What's that about?
There's few actually happening. The first one called Lullabies Under the Stars, and it is with my sister Kalina Sansbury. And it started with the amazing Lydia Fairhall. I went with Rima, with my little one, into El Bijri Theatre before she left up north. And she sang Rima, a First Nation song, like a lullaby. And I said, like, why no one share these songs with us? You know, why these songs are not shared everywhere? Like, why there's no rhyme storytelling and like in well, that First Nation run in Australia? That should be in A, you know, in all these kind of mum's groups. And we started talking about a show before she left up north. And then I was thinking about languages and lullabies as stars and as something that keep the stars in Australia, like keep the stars in the skies, not necessarily Australia, it can be any sky. And thinking about the 300 languages that people should speak and the 300 languages that lullabies should be sang in, where everybody's now singing Twinkle Twinkle. What about all the culture that we are sharing? And the like this collaboration is actually bringing mums where the mums become the hero of the show, where the mums sing the songs for the children. And the children, instead of like seeing, which I love, but seeing Bluey or whatever as the, you know, the hero in the stage, they see their own mums singing in their own languages. They see their own heroes as little ones becoming the center. And we tell the people that as long as there's no songs happening, the stars that were familiar with those songs and they stopped hearing them, they will not come back. And the more moms share songs, the children more enriched with those kind of atmospheres. And then the stars come back and create different First Nation and Palestinian elements of like animals and creations. And that's where kind of the children, they came back. Actually, yes, this kind of the hero, the song, the language is actually what will bring the stars. And the stars in this case are the children, are, you know, them being so passionate about their culture. When you say to your child at home, speaking Arabic, and she doesn't hear Arabic anywhere but in the kitchen, that's kind of like they will stop asking like that. They will stop practicing the language. But when they see their moms on theaters and in stages and in different places around the world talking in their own language, they will figure out that actually, of course I should speak that language. That language should be heard and celebrated and honored, not only in the kitchen, not only in the house, but everywhere outside of it as well. So that's the first collaboration. The second one is also with Kalina, with Jason Tamru, Yora Yora, Auntie Lubin is supporting it and kind of mentoring it. Gary Lang, an amazing uncle as well in Darwin. Like many amazing artists are supporting it to kind of create. And there is, and we will talk about that separately as well. There's like some producers, Maori and Palestinians in New Zealand. There's Nuke, a artist from Greenland, a First Nation, a Palestinian playwright and dramaturg. So we are, there's Norwegian First Nations. We are working with different First Nations around the world to talk about First Nation practices of land and how can we bring all these, you know, kind of knowledge to create a children's theatre that talks about those practices and how if only colonizers didn't misuse our soils, how would that change and where would our land be? It's kind of in the progress. It's still in development. We have done our first small part of it. But I have a lot of hope because all these elements of the project about First Nation, children, climate change are really important topics we have to keep talking about. It's not something that's happening in 50 years. It's something that we have been living in the last 10 and 20 and 30. So it's kind of how can we be more active in these conversations? And there's nothing more interesting than children to bring those spaces into, you know.
Amazing. You're so prolific, Asil. You've got this incredible energy. One of the first places I visited in Melbourne was the Immigration Museum. And I cried when I saw the suitcases and bags that migrants and refugees carry. You know, my grandparents were migrants and my parents were migrants. And I know that you've got a soft spot and a soft place in your heart for, you know, the luggage and what people carry with them when they move. Can you tell us some more about Bukja? You look like you're going to cry, darling.
No, I'm listening. It is a soft space. Bukja is my heart. Bukja is really as deep as I can go into passion about, you know, stories of home and having to leave it. As a child, as a Palestinian child, I was born and raised in a place that have seen those sacks of belongings carried by people. I would not say celebrate, but I have honored those moments of those who have left home first and always wondered really deeply of what was it that these people have taken home, like when they have left home. Like what was the magical bukje? Like what was magical in that sack that whenever there's an uncle mourning home, he will be healed by it. Whenever there's a sick child, he will like find it. Whenever there's a hungry, like what was in that magical bukje that made people survive in camps more than 70 years? But then I came to Australia and I saw many faces. Like I really, and in Palestine, it's not a migrant country. We have only Palestinians, Israelis. That's who you see around you. But coming into a country that have many faces and skin shapes and smiles and like everything that you can even imagine in a diverse space, I was always wondering, really curiously, as child kind of curiosity can go, what did these people face? Like what made them leave their homes? Because really deeply, no one really likes leaving home, because that's why we call it home. Unless you have to. It's like I book my ticket the day I come back from my previous flight. You know, I make sure I arrive to Australia, the first income I can get into, I buy the next one. That connection to home is not, you know, questionable. So why would people leave? And like, what happened to those in Vietnam? Because even in Palestinian culture, we sing for Vietnamese and their war. What happened to those in South Sudan? What happened to those in, you know, all the people that have been forced to leave home? And what's happening now in Syria? You know, ages ago, there was no social media, but now we see everything happening now from those that have experienced it, and that even enrich our understanding even more. So I feel like what started as a sack of installation at Footscray Community Art Centre in 2014 became something that is, you know, a community, a movement, a group of amazing artists, a passionate humans about storytelling. Those that really come to us and say, we want more. Like, I want my child to know about these histories. One of the productions was a story of a 94-year-old man that in the end, the audience of the space was for 3 days, his children, grandchildren, grand-grandchildren, like 4 generations of magic that came and listened to it. And when someone asked me a few days ago, what is a successful event look like? It's presentation and representation. It's the pain of the people and the stories of the people presented by those who lived it, those who understand it, and those who care for it and hold it with like a soft hand, as if they're carrying a feather and delivering it back with all the love, without cutting the edges, without editing the white kind of crime in it, without having all of this, but really honor it as it's told, as it's presented to people. And that's what Bukta is. We don't cut anything. We make it as it is told. Maybe we cut the length of it, but the depth, never out of the conversation. We tell it as is. And like everybody that sits within the space feel it's their own story. That's how deep things go with us. So I'm like a proud mama of that baby. It's a birth, it's a giving birth to this, you know, space and this movement. Every event we have a whole new community join us, which is like magic. It's really like magic. And I'm just passionate about seeing where in a few years that will go, what stories we are going to tell. And people now approach us in mental health, they approach us in domestic violence. They think that art, the stories and the way we tell the stories come in so many ways that we cannot give, you know, let that go. We have to bring it in into every section of life that can bring healing into it and kind of, you know, integrate into those places.
I keep thinking of you as a bridge. You know, you're someone who works to bridge all kinds of experiences, make connections across cultures, languages, and communities. Food's also a really important part of what you do, isn't it?
Yes. That's when you don't see me cry. This is when you see my face is like lighting. Food is definitely something I really care about. I burnt lots of dishes and lots of pots because you don't really get taught how to do things. You just live it, you know? No one really come and sit till you, that's how you roll a dolma, you know? You just watch, you know, 5-10 different aunties gather around the pot and make it, you know? So as someone that have been busy studying, my mom didn't even care about teaching me anything, you know? Like, she's like, she will learn when she get married, you know? As magic just happens. But I grown up in a community and in a family that have at least 10 chefs in it, you know, like in chefs that have restaurants, chefs that have own catering, chefs that create food for 3,000-4,000 people invited to weddings, those that have their own conditoria. Like, it's, you know, a family of chefs. And I learned to kind of watch them, but never really thought that I can do it. You know, they were just like, she cannot do it. Like, they don't really take you seriously when you are a little one. They just feed you. And because we are a culture of generosity, you just enjoy the given food that you don't really think that you should, you know, eat it. You know, you should like make it. You're just like giving too much that you don't even need to make your own. But being in Australia, and especially in WA, when it's not as rich in food like Melbourne is, it was such a hard place to be. And the first few McLubes I definitely have burnt. But I started slowly making it. I started slowly kind of getting to understand what really makes the best McLube. But also not only that, but also the kube and this and that. Like, what makes delicious food? And because I studied pharmacy before I studied art, not many people know about that, but art became my lab. You know, I became kind of understanding what goes with what, literally, like as I'm mixing different chemicals to make something happen. I had explosions. I had like a bumped eggplant because I forgot to make a, you know, hole in it or whatever. But I slowly, you know, just, I feel like mastered some things. And especially the best kind of part of that magic and chemistry was when people are added around the table. And when I knew who exactly to have around that circle table I have around my house, and started enjoying the music of the in the place and the on the, you know, in the stove. As an artist, it all become like a kind of a musical installation. Even if people don't look around it, at it or feel it like this, but as the artist that eat last and the chef that just doesn't eat ever until everybody is fed and the last to sit and join the table, it's kind of, it become like an art installation therapies that no one have planned and no one knows about but you, the artist. During COVID, if you remember, I did many art classes because I really missed my friends around the meal, and I would started sending them like some shopping list and they will go and buy things and join me. And they started inviting me to even do it to their own teams at work or their own kind of, you know, colleagues. And I did more than 50 classes within like 3 months of COVID, which was crazy busy. Now I'm taking lists of that because that also take a lot, especially on Zoom. But yeah, I just love telling stories around food. We did an event at Queen Victoria Market as well, with like, we have, you know, transformed the space of a small space into a whole kitchen and a whole kind of living room. It's part of your responsibilities on your shoulders is to share, you know, your culture and your story through maklube, like through any dish become the story of those resistant women. It's not about the dish. It's about everybody that made it happen over the last 100 years, you know? So it's another intercultural space to kind of share love and the in the room without getting into troubles.
So Asil, you know, you're someone who's been very hardworking, very motivated, very energetic, and an incredible networker. Are these the kinds of qualities that have helped you to get where you are? You know, you've been here 10 years now. What advice might you give to new migrants or new parents who are here from another country?
Yeah, it is my 10th year in Australia. And it's kind of like, it took me a while to understand what really works in this place and how people exist in within those systems, because it's a bit different to where we come from, and everybody comes from a different culture of how people, you know, network and talk and make things happen. And what one thing I keep thinking about and telling everybody I meet that just recently came as moms and as women in general is keep knocking the doors. And sometimes if the door is not open, maybe take it off. Knock doors as much as you can. Now, like that I am solo parenting with my daughter and for a while, it's kind of like I, for the first time, dared to ask for help. I had a semi-COVID kind of thing and I was by myself and I just started messaging people, I am by myself, I need help. And sometimes people are waiting for you to ask for that. People are waiting for that moment to kind of say, oh, how can I make it? Like, how can I be a help? I'm your neighbor. And sometimes people just want that. Some people really love giving, but they don't know how to. And especially in a culture that is very individual in Australia, they think that the offer of help is not really respected or not really welcomed. So making that space of like opening that door to make people like, hey, yes, I would love your help. I would like you to be the auntie to my daughter or the grandmother for my child will really make people feel happy that you don't expect that they do, but they will wait for that moment. So that's one thing. Work-wise, I have always loved and created network around my own work, but I have never dared to ask those networks for help for years. And I'm now, like, because I love them, because they're my friends. How can I go to a friend and say, help me? Because they are, I love them because who they are, not because of what they do, you know? But I started, and as someone that gave me that kind of advice, you have to. like a person that I asked for an advice and I spoke to recently said, you have to go to those who you know. Yeah, don't start building extra network while you still haven't asked your actual existing network for this. And people will say, but how? No, it's not appropriate. You know, they are friends. Because they are friends, they are the ones believing you most. And they will think that it's not appropriate to offer you help because they will see you as, you're fine. But the vulnerability space of being vulnerable and saying, I can't do it anymore. I need your help. Hands and like to take me to those places is magic. And people don't understand and people underestimate the magic that happen when people ask for help. I have been asking for help in the last few years, but mostly from friends in the last few months. And it is magic when you say, hey, I'm struggling. I really need to grow. I need to create more of this. This kind of, you know, idea of mine, this should go to 20 schools or 50 theaters or like 100, you know, houses. How can we make that happen? And people actually love to help. They believe in you. They are your friends because not only because you have a beautiful hair, but because you have an amazing talent and because you are bringing lots of connections and network and, you know, passion to the space. They love you because of your soul. And that soul needs help and they acknowledge it, but they don't, they assume that you are fine. So cut that assumption and say, bring all these kind of thoughts and struggles you have and share them with those you know and also with those you don't. Because like just before this meeting, I had an amazing conversation with an amazing woman that just made me feel I'm the only one on earth because of the way she described my work. And I cried because I felt that no one sees this. But you will also be empowered by those who believe in you, but you haven't had the chance to meet them yet. And once you do, that will also, they will not, might not give you a funding or not create any work for you, but that push of few words that will make you feel special will make it continue for an extra kind of amount of energy that you're filled in that will create the next idea and next thought. It's the birth, talking about birth of a new life and collaboration and relationship that you thought didn't exist. And that's kind of the birth, you know, special births I love to celebrate that come like a coincidence without 9 years of 9 months of pregnancy, without all the vomiting and hardship, and just come with no sickness, but with joy and love. And it's not as less special when it's really kind of cooked beautifully, you know? So that's definitely an advice. Just don't assume things. Stop the assumptions. They're not helpful for anyone. Just try, you know?
Asil, you're someone who brings a lot of joy and love to those whose lives you touch. And I'm wondering if you can share with listeners where they can find more of your work or where they can connect with you.
We have our bookjay.org website. People can always find us there. We always look for volunteers, for people that would like collaborations, would like to invite us in their spaces and their communities. We always look for those that are, you know, passionate about motherhood or, you know, refugees and asylum seeker stories about climate change and children theatre to sponsor and share our work. But they can also go and like contact me at asiltaya.com, which is my personal work as well. There's amazing artists as well, Les, they can find on the website and they can go and listen to their poetry or music. See their dance as well. There's like amazing community of artists in there. Yeah, I don't have a YouTube or anything like this. You know, like I do, we have a Bookjay kind of channel where they can, you know, listen to some stories for children, but I'm working on it. Many people have been asking me for it, but until then, they can find things on the website.
Thank you, Asil. Do you want to finish with a lullaby for us?
Yeah, I would love to sing a lullaby. I will sing a lullaby that I don't think anyone will find anywhere because it's mom's made. I thought people knew it and I thought she was singing it like as kind of following a tradition. But I now kind of like almost convinced that she just made that up. Like I made trillions of them every night while I was putting Rima to sleep. And it said many lullabies in our culture, it's about a tradition or a belief or like, you know, something that we do or something that we appreciate. Like I'll just give you an example, like in Africa, knowing about lullabies, people, they say, sleep, baby, sleep, but dad is coming soon. Sleep, baby, sleep, he's bringing with him the corn. It's kind of like talking about the fields and what people see around them. while lullabies in Japan, they talk about the maids are the ones that singing lullabies, complaining about how hard were their days, you know, from the masters. So like, but my mom was starting to be very much more religious when she brought us to life. She wasn't a hijabi before, and slowly she wore the hijab and she started being more spiritual. And she said, وَلَنْ مَدَحْتِ النَّبِي مَدْحِ النَّبِي مَحْلَى. If like, if I praise the prophet, how beautiful is that? أَحْلَى مِنْ الشِّهْدِ وَأَحْلَى مِنْ عَسَى النَّحْلَى. It's nicer than honey and better than what bees create. وَلَنْ مَدَحْتِ النَّبِي مَدْحِ النَّبِي مطلوب. If I praise the prophet, it's something that I should. أَحْلَى مِنْ الشِّهْدِ وَأَحْلَى مِنْ لُقَى الْمَحْبُوبِ. It's much nicer than honey and from meeting my lovers. It's kind of like that kind of space. And it goes like, وَلَنْ مَدَحْتِ النَّبِي مَدْحِ النَّبِي مَحْلَى وَأَحْلَى مِنِ الشِّهْدِ وَأَحْلَى مِنْ عَسَى النَّحْلَى وَلَنْ مَدَحْتِ النَّبِي مَدْحِ النَّبِي مَطْلُوبُ وَأَحْلَى مِنِ الشِّهْدِ وَأَحْلَى مِنْ لُقَى الْمَحْبُوبُ وَلَنْ مَدَحْتِ النَّبِي مَدْحِ النَّبِي وَاجِبُ وأحلى من الشهد وأحلى من لقى الحبايب.
A seal! You are truly a magnificent force to behold. Thank you for so generously talking about your commitment to intercultural sharing and storytelling for collective healing. If you'd like to learn more about A Seal, you can find her at asealtaya.com. Next time on Birthing Injustice.
Traditionally, historically, Indians don't adopt. So it's been a great process since then. Very difficult, very challenging. But I think to me, I wouldn't have it any other way.
We've got another amazing force. I'll be speaking with storyteller Dr. Sapna Samant, who's also a GP, writer and filmmaker, and is passionate about telling migrant and refugee stories in her adopted home of Aotearoa, New Zealand. You can find more episodes at ruthdesouza.com/podcasts, including links and transcripts from my conversations with Asil and other guests on the show. If you enjoyed this episode, please tweet about the show or leave a review on your podcast app to help spread the word. Birthing Injustice with Dr. Ruth D'Souza is written, hosted and produced by me and recorded at my home on the traditional lands of the Bunmurrung people of the Eastern Kulin Nations. Our sound design is by our editor, Olivia Smith. Thanks so much for listening, and see you next time.